Take the bass line out. Uh-huh.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox podcast. I am Dan Favalli, coming at you with my incredibly super-duper esteemed, awesome times awesome, fantabulous, spectacular co-host, and we are joined by an equally super-duper, incredibly esteemed, awesome times awesome, fantabulous, spectacular guest, who is also one of the co-founders of Hardwood Knox, slash he is the founder of MBA Math, slash he remains the editor-in-chief of MBA Math, slash he is a writer for Bleacher Report, Mr. Adam Frommel. You can find him on Twitter, at Frommel09. We're so excited to get this throwback pod going, but before we do, I just want to remind everyone to please rate, subscribe, and review us on iTunes. We are closing in on the century mark on the ratings, and so you can help us get there. Andy and I will be in love with you forever. And don't forget to throw us a review in there, too, if you have some thoughts. And definitely, if you haven't already, subscribe to us. If you have, steal your family's phones and subscribe to us. They will thank you later. Friends, family, frenemies, people you don't know on the street, they will all thank you later. The pod is going to be mostly about today, I think, making sense of the shit show that is both the Tankathon and the playoff sweepstakes. We're super excited to get there, but I think the question that everyone really wants to know, with apologies to Andy, is how does it feel to be back, Adam?
I'm so excited to be back, and I feel a lot like Daenerys Targaryen here with that introduction. I kind of want to tack that on to the Twitter profile and just make people refer to me by that at all times.
Can I just say how impressed I am? I think you repeated each of the adjectives that you used for me, like you were five for five or whatever.
Let's I was wondering if you wrote it down.
My memory is so good, I can tell you J.R. Smith's true souping percentage. I'm not sorry.
Oh boy,
I'm not sorry. People hated that joke on Twitter. I was so upset. It was. Did you guys see really quick? J.R. Smith, he threw chicken tortilla soup. That was the report.
Is that confirmed?
Jason Lloyd of The Athletic tweeted it out yesterday.
I'm so glad we know that now.
Do we know why he did it?
Yeah, he's J.R. Smith.
I'm still waiting for, like, what did Damon Jones say or do to piss J.R. Smith off? I know he had, like, a little mini press conference with the media yesterday, but I didn't watch it, so I don't know.
Yeah, he didn't, he didn't really address it. He said he saw the memes, and he was, like, upset. One of the things he said, and this was from... he told all the reporters, but I was reading the Dave McMenamin piece over at ESPN.com. He said, if this was 15 years ago, nobody would have even knew. It's just part of the game. Like, don't throw frickin' soup. It doesn't matter whether new one, don't throw soup.
I have trouble picturing J.R. Smith eating soup. Like, on the list of foods that J.R. Smith would eat, that would be very near the bottom.
Well, chicken's got protein. He wouldn't tell the media either what, honestly, I didn't even remember he said when asked about the soup, but... Jason Lloyd did tweet out that it was chicken tortilla.
Was it warm, like lukewarm?
I hope it's gotta be warm. Who eats cold soup?
I mean, do we even know that he was eating it? Like, what if this was just on a table that somebody else had been eating from, and then he just like picked it up and threw it at him?
Yeah,
there's so many unanswered questions
anywhere. Yeah,
was it?
Maybe he should write a Players Tribune piece on it.
I'd read it.
Oh, I would read it in a heartbeat.
That would probably be the most read piece in that site's history.
Anyway, enough about J.R. Smith's eating preferences, and I'm just going to say enough talking about the Cavs defense already because it doesn't exist and we haven't even got there yet. But Adam had an interesting question out of before we kind of hopped on air. So since he's the guest and I should really be steering him towards it, I want you to pose the question to the listeners and just in general about the Western Conference playoff race right now.
Yeah, so I mean, we're looking at these jam-packed standings in the West, and obviously the Rockets and the Warriors are in, but that leaves eight teams competing for six slots, and no one has any idea how that's going to end up shuffling out. So I'm wondering if there's a single team among that group that you would feel comfortable betting your bank account on them making the playoffs.
I do not.
So that group, yeah, I was going to say I don't either. That group is the Blazers, the Timberwolves, the Pelicans, the Spurs, the Thunder, the Nuggets, the Clippers, and the Jazz. The Blazers and Pelicans have 26 losses. Spurs have 27. Wolves, Pelicans, Thunder, and Nuggets, and Clippers all have 28, and the Jazz have 30. So the difference in the loss column between the third place Blazers and the 10th place Jazz is 4 games.
That's nuts.
And it seems like every night after the like slate of games is over, at least 3 or 4 teams have changed positions in the standings, except for the Jazz, who somehow remain in 10th for, like, in perpetuity.
But it seems to even go beyond that, too, right? Because, like, Butler is out now for the Wolves, and Cousins has been out for the Pelicans, and we know that Kawhi isn't playing anytime soon, and Robertson's gone for the Thunder, and Millsap is coming back for the Nuggets, and Gobert is being worked in for the Jazz. So everything is changing in different orders, and nothing makes sense.
Which one are you closest to having the confidence to make Adam's bet on?
I don't even.
Even that is a hard question.
Yeah, I don't think that I do. I don't understand. Like, I want to say the Thunder, but they've just been so unreliable, even in victories. That win over the Suns, I watched the second half of it basically on Friday. The recent win over the Kings, they needed Russell Westbrook to hit the buzzer beater. The Timberwolves have just been self-destructing without. I don't have a pick. I mean, gun to the head, and this seems so stupid, but I almost feel like the Jazz, just because they're healthy, their schedule's like one of the 10 easiest remaining in the league, and their record has come while basically playing out like the toughest schedule in the league right now. So that sounds so stupid to say, because they're in 10th right now and 2 games back in the loss column of the playoff race. But I don't trust the Clippers. I don't know. The Blazers have been spectacular. They're starting to win games again at home, but there's something about them that just makes me, I don't know, uneasy. Maybe their like offense was too bad for too long, or maybe I'm not a like Nurkic guy. I honestly don't know. And they, you know, they do have the 5th hardest remaining schedule in the West and in the league. So it's just, it's so hard to predict. Do you have anyone, Adam, that you would even wager a guess on?
Not at all, but I think if you pose the same question to me, like gun to my head, which team am I picking? It would probably be Portland, which I'm having trouble wrapping my head around, but they do have a half game advantage over everybody else, which I guess has to matter at some level. And I believe in their defense. And that's more than I can say about like any other team right now, just because there's so many questions and so many mixing pieces with every other team, and they're the one where they're at least enjoying some semblance of continuity. But again, they have the 5th toughest schedule remaining, so who the hell knows?
Yeah, I was going to say the Blazers too, and Dan throwing out their remaining schedule kind of made me hesitant as well. But yeah, they're 37-26 right now, like Adam mentioned. That's 3 games ahead of the 9th place Clippers. So they're only 2 ahead in the loss column, but they're 3 games ahead overall. I think they have plenty of star power at the top. Damian Lillard's been unbelievable this season. And I think we've even talked about this on the pod. At certain points this season, I've really sort of been down on that roster after their top 2 guys. Shabazz Napier had a really nice run for a while. But so, I mean, in the past, I've talked about not being as confident in them, but they just, I think the word continuity is big, which Adam just brought up. They've had most of this group together for a couple of years now. They seem to be sort of clicking in at the right time. They're 8-2 in their last 10, which is a better record in the last 10 than every other team in this discussion, other than the Jazz, who are also 8-2 in their last 10. So they just seem to be sort of hitting their stride at the right moment. The other team that I was tempted to pick, though, is the Pelicans, and I'm wondering, Dan, if you have their remaining strength of schedule.
Yes, I do. They have in the league, it's 8th. In the conference, it's 6th.
So like 6th hardest.
6th hardest in the conference, 8th hardest in the league. So it's, you know, I mean, and the thing when we say this though is it might actually matter more in the conference than in the league, because Western Conference teams playing Western Conference teams just means, I mean, if you look like, yeah, sure. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8 teams from the West have a top 10 hardest schedule remaining in the league. So that's like, that's completely skewed by the conference. So the conference standing is more important, and 6th hardest in the conference you know, when you're looking, the Clippers, Blazers, Thunder, and Spurs all have a harder remaining schedule than them.
One thing I've been really struggling to grapple with here that ties in is whether you would rather have fewer games remaining or more games remaining. Like, do you want to be the Thunder with only 17 left, or do you want to be the Clippers with 21 left? Because I can't really tell if the teams that get in are going to do so by getting hot or by avoiding getting cold.
That's a good question.
I guess if you're the Timberwolves, you'd rather have the less because you don't have Butler. But
yeah.
Because you're not getting hot.
Yeah, I guess it would be situation specific. If you were of the mind that I want to control my own destiny, I guess you would probably want more to either give yourself more of a cushion or make up more ground. But that's a good point about the Timberwolves. They certainly don't want more games without Jimmy Butler. Have you guys seen their remaining schedule or looked at it lately?
The Timberwolves?
Yeah, it's pretty middle ground.
Well, just listen to their next, I think, 8 games. At home against the Celtics, at home against the Warriors, on the road against the Wizards, on the road against the Spurs, at home against the Rockets, at home against the Clippers, on the road against the Knicks, and on the road against the Sixers.
I mean, there's a chance they might win one of those games.
I was going to just say the same thing. The Knicks, look, that game in New York should probably be a win. They could go 1-7 in the rest of those 8, which would be 10-game stretch that's 1-9.
That's less than ideal, I think.
So that's another team to certainly look at, is like, they could legitimately miss out on this thing.
I think fortunately for them, though, the rest of their schedule after that is pretty easy, so long as they survive this portion. I'm looking at Tankathon for remaining schedule strengths and still seeing them at the 13th hardest remaining. It definitely works to their advantage that they have the fewest games remaining of any NBA team. So like it'll be rough for the next week or so, but it should ease up.
But is there mentally, spiritually, when you don't have Jimmy Butler, let's say they go 2-8 over their next 10, and I'll be shocked. The games you named, I'll be shocked if they win more than 2. Is there any way to come back from that, though? And even if, and the other thing that we can't
forget. That would certainly rattle them, for sure.
Right, and the other thing that we can't forget is that once Jimmy Butler comes back, like, we're assuming, is it even going to be before the end of the regular season? Probably not. And even if it is, you have to work on reintegrating him, and he's probably not going to be the same Jimmy Butler. And while he could, in theory, that might work on offense because you could just have him like be a spot-up guy and just not assume as much of the ball handling because you have Towns and Wiggins and Teague, even Tyus Jones and Crawford coming off the bench. Like, that's not going to help your defense, which is already bad. So the strength of their schedule is almost – like, this stretch could – like, they need to – we've seen them self-destruct at, like, that game against the Jazz. They were leading for much of that game against the Blazers on Thursday night, and Portland eventually came back. Like, this could just be one of those, like, psychologically, like, denigrating stretches that they're just not able to come back from.
I think it's important to remember that Kat always lands on his feet, though.
Oh, God.
He
didn't you miss me?
Adam, that was such a good joke that I completely lost my train of thought.
That was such a bad joke that I've been vomiting
for
the past 15 seconds.
What if the Spurs miss?
That was a scenario that Adam proposed before the thing, or maybe it was you, Andy, I can't remember, before we started recording, saying there's a chance that both the Thunder and the Spurs could miss the playoffs. That's
Let's
it.
Look at
That's
those
like,
remaining
I don't
schedules.
Have any other thoughts besides just reiterating what one of you said before the podcast.
I mean, that was me, and I think Andy had been toying with that idea beforehand as well. But it's one of those things where it's so inconceivable yet possible that dumbfounded silence is probably an appropriate way to follow that up.
Let's look at the Spurs' remaining schedule. You might have already mentioned it, but I can't remember if it was
the hardest in the league.
Yeah, it is the hardest remaining schedule in the league.
So that's not ideal. And of course, we've talked about the Kawhi Leonard injury story on here before. I mean, it would seem so Spursy if they missed the playoffs and then won the lottery, like, out of the best odds. Or if they found somebody that was, like, it also would be very Spursy if they found the best player in this draft at, like, number 14. The 50 win season streak is probably over too. Is there any, like, I don't know, is there any reason for lasting concern for the Spurs if they miss the playoffs? Like, are they in danger of losing Kawhi now?
No one really knows what's up with that relationship, right? The thing I'd be more concerned about is immediately is what's up with LaMarcus Aldridge's ankle. They probably don't need him against the Grizzlies when they face them, but, like, if he misses any sort of time, their offense has not been good when he's not on the floor.
Yeah, who's their go-to guy if both of those guys are out?
Patty Mills time.
That's,
I guess, daunting. We could see a lot of Manu too.
There was, yeah. So they closed the game, and I haven't looked this up, and I haven't necessarily seen a ton of the lineup, but they closed the game against the Pelicans, or they played a lot of those final minutes against the Pelicans with Gay, Manu, Mills, Murray, and Bertans on the floor. And I was like watching this lineup, and I was like, I really like this lineup, but it cannot play defense. And it was the first time that they rolled it out, apparently, and it was for a 5-minute stretch, and their net rating during that 5 minutes was a -53.4. Oof, defensive rating of 144.5. I mean, again, it's 5 minutes, but the offense, just looking at it, like, it looked like it could hum, and maybe there's some variation defense, like, you could take, like, if you had Kawhi back in the fold and you put him in for Rudy Gay, like, maybe that lineup becomes exponentially better. I don't know. So that was just interesting. But that's what they're left to do at this point, right? Is, like, they're futzing and fiddling with a rotation in a way that they're not used to, like, not having a go-to guy, like, even a semblance of one. If LaMarcus Aldridge misses time, who do you go to? I mean, Parker and Ginobili are past their prime. You don't have Kawhi. Your offense without LaMarcus Aldridge on the floor this year is averaging 101.7 points per 100 possessions, which is akin to ranking 27th overall. It's worse than the, excuse me, I lied. It's the akin of ranking 28th. It's worse than the Atlanta Hawks, which is saying something. So I penciled the Spurs in as a lock, and I still think I have too much blind faith in the Spurs to pick them as one of the, and we're probably going to need to get to that so that we could sort through it as who do you guys have out, but I just find it tough to leave the Spurs out. I'm wondering, who do you think's more likely to miss, though, the Thunder or the Spurs? Is it for you, Adam? Is it San Antonio?
I think it is, and we haven't really mentioned many concerns with their defense, but it seems like they've slowed down a little bit. This is a veteran-laden team that is going to have trouble down the stretch because the wear and tear of the season takes its toll. So since the beginning of February, they've played 10 games. They're 2-8, which is very un-Spursy. And they have 109.1 defensive rating, which is 19th over that span. So for this team to win, we've seen all season that it had to be on the backs of a dominant defense. Like, they've been one of the top two or three defenses all season long. And with concerns about LaMarcus Aldridge, who has been their offense, not a key piece of their offense, but he has been their offense. If the defense slips at all, that's really concerning. And there's no margin for error here.
I'm going to see if I can I think I might be with Adam here, and I'm going to see if I can dissuade Dan from his lock for the Spurs. So they are 2-8 in their last 10, like Adam just said. Listen to their next 10. Versus the Grizzlies, that's not concerning. But then they go at Golden State, at Oklahoma City, at Houston. Orlando is a nice break for them. Then it's at home against the Pelicans, at home against the Wolves, at home against the Warriors, at home against the Wizards, and at home against the Jazz. So it's nice that last stretch is all at home, but that's out of 10, there are 8 playoff teams in there. Two of those games are against the Warriors, who seem determined to go on a little run here. I think Klay Thompson even said the other day that he talked to Curry about wanting to rip off another big winning streak because he felt like they hadn't done it in a while. This is another team that I think could be facing that psychological barrier that you were talking about earlier, Dan. Like, they're already in the midst of a rough stretch, and it could get even worse in the next couple weeks.
That stretch, like, doesn't even bother me so much for some reason. The Warriors games and the Rockets games feel like washes, like they're gonna get beat. I don't know that there's another team on there that totally scares me. If the Spurs aren't defending as well, as Adam said, over their last 10, and even over their last 20 games, they're outside the top 10 in defensive efficiency, which is a big deal. I even said it before, I don't think that I'm making a rational decision, so to speak, but it's just having the blind faith in the Spurs. But I readily admit that, look at LaMarcus Aldridge, even when he's healthy. The Spurs, one, they're 13-21, I believe, against teams above 500. That's a problem. It's the second worst record among the West top teams against winning squads this season. But even like Aldridge, if he's your offensive hub, he subsists on a really tough turnaround. Jumpers are a huge share of his offense, and that's not the way to necessarily run an efficient offense for an entire season. The Spurs are lucky that they've kind of gotten away with it till this point when he's on the floor, and then to have you be so reliant on that guy to where your offense just plunges when he steps off, that's a hell of a line to toe. So I
think you're helping us make our point here.
But I'm saying it's not rational. It's just, the other thing is I don't. So for me, starting there, I think the two teams that miss it in the West as of now are going to end up being the Nuggets and the Clippers. And I just don't trust the Clippers, even though they've been fun. They're 7-3 over their last 10. This is, I think Andy and I have talked about this before. This is one of Doc Rivers' better coaching jobs, maybe his best coaching job. I'm not there with them yet. Their defensive success over this stretch feels kind of hollow to me. When I look at their roster, I don't see it. I just don't see a ton of defensive talent on there. And for the Nuggets, I know they're getting Millsap back, but there have been problems to kind of balance him and Nikola Jokic all season. And then a big thing for me is they've already played 33 home games, so they're going to have a fairly road-heavy schedule the rest of the way. They have 11 games remaining at home. So, 11-9 isn't that much, but they're 11-19 away from Pepsi Center, and that's just not – and they're barely 500 in the conference. I don't know. There's something about them that I just feel – and I really like the Nuggets, but there's something about them after you go beyond when Millsap's healthy, you go beyond their sixth guy – on the roster, and there it just doesn't feel like there's any reliable production whatsoever.
This is This is a sentence I couldn't really have imagined saying before the season started, but I'm definitely worried about the Clippers staying in the playoff race now that they can't get any more out of Tyrone Wallace. And I'm entirely serious.
Is his he was on a 45-day or a 10-day or one of those, right? Is he officially off the roster now?
He's officially off the roster. He turned down a 4-year contract offer from them. They're looking into Derrick Rose because they can't figure out what they're going to do with Wallace. And he was a pretty crucial part of the recent success, the defensive intensity, the ability to get to the basket, giving them another guard alongside Lou Williams. This team is not exactly flush with talent, especially compared to the other teams that are competing for these playoff spots. And losing a piece like that, who's played a big role lately, is a significant loss.
I had no idea he turned down a 4-year offer. That seems crazy for a player in that position.
Yeah, I don't know the details of that contract.
Yeah, that's weird.
I'm assuming every single season was non-guaranteed, basically.
Yeah, it must have been something like that.
I'm with you guys. I'm not super confident in the Clippers either. Concerning the Nuggets, we talked about this a little bit before we started recording. This is so strange to me that it seems like I think they're a better team when Millsap is in the lineup. The numbers show that. That sort of typical starting five they have with Murray, Harris, Chandler, Millsap, and Jokic has been really good all season. For some reason, though, just his presence on the floor seems to persuade Jokic not to shoot, and it's just so strange to me. From January 1st up until Millsap's return, Jokic was taking 14 shots a game. He was averaging 18 points, 11 rebounds, and 8 assists, those numbers are just insane, obviously. In the 3 games since Millsap's been back, he's averaging 6 shots a game. Is he just deferring too much to sort of help Millsap get his legs back underneath him? Is this something that is like a legitimate concern for you guys for the Nuggets is figuring out how to play those two guys together, or do we just trust the numbers and say they've been beating teams pretty handily when they're both on the floor, so don't worry about it?
Well, Jokic is a naturally passive player. He generally wants to create for others rather than do any of the heavy lifting. He's pretty much one of the NBA's anti-stars, even though he plays like a star, right? So it seems like from watching the Nuggets, it really feels like he's doing the deferring to Millsap when it should be happening the other way around. I'm not sure that it's a big concern because, like you said, the numbers definitely work in this lineup's favor. But for me, it seems to be a floor versus ceiling issue where with Millsap and Jokic on the floor, the Nuggets are going to be good. Like there's too much talent on the floor at all times when they're playing for them to hemorrhage points, for them to blow big leads. But the ceiling isn't quite there like it is when the ball is always in Jokic's hands and he's making everyone else better.
And I feel like they could still do that with Millsap in the lineup. Like I think they could play the same way as they did when Barton and Chandler were starting at the three and the four. Somebody just has to convince those two, Millsap and Jokic, to play that way. I don't know. I think it was Josh Lloyd. He hosts the Locked On Fantasy Basketball podcast the other day. He said something like, I just don't understand how the Malone and Millsap don't see it. Because you saw it play out so well for the last 2 months. I don't know why they wouldn't want to just plug him in and say, continue to do what the other guys were doing. And that sounds weird, especially to say that to an all-star. But
Malone-Jokic relationship is so strange, though. And it has been
all season. Yeah, it is. Go into that.
Yeah, like they seem to get along well. He seems to boost his confidence when it's necessary. And granted, I haven't spent any time around the team this season like I have in the last couple of years. But we've seen the quotes where he'll say that Gary Harris is the team's best player. And it's bizarre that there hasn't been more of a commitment to Jokic being the face of the franchise, with the exception of the occasional quote where he says that he should be in the MVP race or something like that. But it doesn't seem like the actions back up the words there.
It's been weird dating. Like, remember the whole like Josef Nurkic thing?
So weird.
Yeah, so it's been weird dating back. They seem close. We know Malone went to Serbia to see Jokic over the summer. So part of it seems like, hey, maybe they are close. But then you just look at some of the decision-making, like how, one, what he did with Nurkic, two, and how long
it
took
him to...
But
he tried it again with Plumlee this season, too.
Right, and then to let Millsap... And you don't want to say that Millsap is hijacking the Nuggets offense, so to speak, but to continue to not have players adjust around Jokic, it seems, when he's supposed to be your franchise centerpiece. Mike Malone, who I actually, and maybe I'm just biased because I'm a member of the media and he seems like he's a very candid, just very open quote, but is his job going to be in jeopardy if the Nuggets don't make the playoffs?
Yes.
It has to be, right? Because they'll be up against the tax if they max out Jokic, as a lot of people think they will, should they decline his team option. And there is a path for them to carve out space if they dump other contracts, but this isn't a team that is flush with great home attendance standings. And if you don't make the playoffs or if you get bounced in the first round, I don't know that you're willing to dive in to the luxury tax right away. So it could be a matter of, well, the coaching staff is something that we have the power to change, like a Hornets type situation.
There are people close to the team that have said that if they miss the playoffs, that his job will be in jeopardy. And Malone is such an interesting figure here because his identity as an NBA head coach has been predicated upon defensive ability forever. I mean, that's been his calling card. And it's I think some of the hesitation to fully embrace Jokic and build a lineup and schemes around him has been that offense is better than defense for him. And that working in that manner is going to ensure that the Nuggets are winning games by scoring 130 points and allowing 120. And that's been tough for him to adjust to and to fully accept. And my guess is, and this is purely conjecture, is that having the luxury of having Millsap back in the lineup, who has been a fringe defensive player of the year candidate in previous seasons with the Hawks, fills him with some sort of confidence that they can start winning games through defense again. And that's why we're seeing more adjustments than we should.
The one thing I want to add before Bandy, I'm sure, Bandy, wow. Bailey Bales, Andy has something. I'm sure he has something to say. So before Millsap returned, like these, the Nuggets are just. It's as Andy said before, the Nuggets can still be good with them on the floor, even if the dynamic isn't perfect, because they were a plus 9.7 points per 100 possessions in the 325 minutes they locked together before Millsap's injury. And since he came back, they're not nearly as potent, and the offense is just it's mediocre at best. It's a 104.7 offensive rating, but they're still a net plus per 100 possessions, plus 1.4. There's to have it be far from perfect or far from working, and the pairing between them still be effective or on the fringes of effective. Does that spell out a larger coaching failure? Because then they have the potential to be even better, or are we just making too much of the issue and it will come with time? Because again, the Nuggets and even their starting lineup, if you look before Millsap's injury, they were outscoring opponents by basically 12 points per 100 possessions. That Millsap included starting five.
It was one of the best lineups in the league.
Right. My question is it a coaching failure because we're still seeing these numbers? And even when they're at their worst, they can still be effective, which makes you think, well, then why aren't they even better? Or, and maybe I shouldn't say at their worst, because they could certainly be worse. Or are we just overblowing this and, hey, it's been three games into Millsap's return. Let's just ride this out and see what happens.
I think it's probably a little bit of both of those. Yeah. Give them some more time to come together. But my macro take on this is you have a guy who can consistently get you 20 points, 12 rebounds, and 7 or 8 assists.
Are we talking about Boban or Jokic?
Both. there's almost like a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde quality with Nikola Jokic. You could get two different players showing up in the same body on a given night. I feel like you got to do whatever you can to get that 20-12-8 guy. And somebody, whether it's Malone or some assistant coach, needs to be in his ear and saying, we just cannot have games where you take five shots. You are our best player. You're not just our best distributor. You're our best scorer. Somebody just needs to be building him up, and they need to get that 20-12-8 guy as often as they possibly can. And if that comes at the expense of Millsap, so be it. I mean, he's obviously an all-star, but he's in his 30s and he's only going to be there for another couple years. This is your franchise centerpiece in Jokic, and you got to do whatever you can to build that guy up.
This is going to sound weird, but I think if we want to maximize Jokic for his entire career, the best case scenario this year would be missing the playoffs, because There are definitely some people throughout the NBA who don't care about stats, and Jokic is absolutely one of them, where he just wants to be making the right plays. He wants to be winning games. And if he spends the last quarter of the season deferring and trying to work Millsap in and not doing what he did throughout January and early February, and they miss the playoffs, then we could see a mentality shift.
That's a good point. Yeah, I like that.
The irony is that he kind of needs someone like Millsap, because it's so tough to build a league average to above average defense with Jokic as your defensive linchpin. And there are aspects of his defense that are, I don't want to use the word underrated, but we exacerbate like his flaws. We're not when we're watching him play defense, he's not the worst defender in the NBA. He's not the best rim protector. He's far from it, but he's not the worst. He can't survive in space for long periods of time, but he's certainly not the slowest lumbering big in the league. At the same time, you do kind of need that safety net like Millsap. So it kind of seems like they need each other, but they're just playing, as of right now, at least offensively, maybe they're playing the wrong way together. And I agree with everything both of you said. There shouldn't be nights, Jokic's shots with Millsap in a game right now are declining by like 4+ per 36 minutes. That really his usage rate is dropping by more than 5 percentage points. That really shouldn't happen. And if it's happening, you should see his assist rate go through the roof with Millsap on the floor, which it has not. So,
yeah, I don't know. Hopefully it just works itself out over time. Like you said, I feel like we've spent more time on the Nuggets than any other team. Are there any others in the West we want to look at?
Well, here's my question. Who are the two teams you guys are leaving out of the Western Conference playoff race? As of now, or I guess for Andy, it's a justice.
Let's start with Adam on this.
I don't even feel a little bit bad making you pick. Is that bad?
No, I mean, we have to pick, but it's so hard. I think the bottom three for me would be the Clippers due to a lack of talent relative to the rest of the field. The Thunder, who I don't think they're nearly as good without their best defender. Sorry, Paul George. And the Spurs, who I think are in serious trouble. I don't think I'm bold enough to pick both the Spurs and the Thunder. So I'll go with the Spurs and the Clippers missing.
I was thinking I'm going to go the bold, go big or go home route.
I respect it.
I'm going to say the Spurs and the Thunder just because.
What?
I've had plenty of takes on this podcast that turned out to be insane, so I'm going to keep going with that trend.
I'm going to, I guess, play.
Dan is very surprised.
Both? It's just, I don't know how you look.
Want the chaos, Dan.
Okay, first of all, if we go into, like, the last game of the season and the Thunder, both the Thunder and the Spurs are in, like, win or go home situations, I'll love it. Don't get me wrong, but I don't
know. Who are the last teams on their schedule? Do we know?
The Pelicans and the Spurs, I think, closed the season together. Ooh. Again. Remember that a few years ago where the Spurs could have finished, what was it, anywhere between 2-7, and they were playing the Pelicans, and like the Pelicans needed to win to get in, and they lost, so the Pelicans got in, and the Spurs ended up sixth. And then I think that was the same year they lost to the Clippers in the first round. So those games
matter. OKC's
final game is Memphis.
Oh, that helps. The Spurs have the Rockets, the Clippers, the Lakers, the Blazers, the Kings, and the Pelicans in April.
In April, the Thunder have the Pelicans, the Warriors, the Rockets, the Heat, the Grizzlies. So they have a cupcake game to close the year, but
yeah, the rest of those are rough.
I'm
going with both of them. Hot take time.
I'm just okay. So your case then, you need to be building a hell of a case for the Clippers to get in. I don't know how you look at the Jazz, the Nuggets, and the Clippers and say that, and then the Timberwolves without Jimmy Butler and say that they're going to get into the playoffs. Oh, like all of those teams are going to get into the playoffs over the Spurs and the Thunder. You know what's crazy?
Timberwolves without Jimmy Butler to me is like harder to defend than the Clippers right now. Is that crazy?
The Clippers don't have a Karl Anthony Towns.
Yeah.
And also, as a side note, we need a siren button or sound effect for hot takes.
That's a good idea, because I would be slamming that thing right now.
I feel like that needs to happen. Like Andy says, Spurs and Thunder miss the playoffs. Boom! Siren goes off.
I know I was initially going to leave the Nuggets and the Clippers out, but I almost want to put the Timberwolves and the Clippers out of the playoff picture is almost what I'm leaning towards at this point.
And you've been kind of cold on the Wolves for a while now.
Even when so they I'll were good.
Yeah.
Quote, bunny quotes, good.
I'm guessing you didn't predict Jimmy Butler going out, but still.
But I would have never have penciled them out of the playoff picture if Jimmy Butler was healthy,
yeah.
That's for sure.
That's true.
But yeah. They still have all-star snub Andrew Wiggins, though.
I mean, so in his defense, he does look more comfortable in the role that
you just used Wiggins and defense in the same sentence.
I was actually wondering if you were going to mention anything about that. In his defense, though, he does seem more comfortable in the role that he's currently in without Jimmy Butler than he was with him. Now, to be even more fair, that's arguably additionally concerning because the long-term outlook is, hey, Jimmy Butler's going to be here. So I don't know. I was low on the Wolves to begin with, and I don't know how I don't know how they're going to win games without him. Karl Anthony Towns has been mostly amazing since he went out, but now you're going to have minutes because you have to have minutes where both Karl Anthony Towns and Jimmy Butler aren't on the floor all of a sudden, which is just – that's hell on earth
and
for the Timberwolves.
It's scary with, yeah.
Can you?
Think about the rosters that they can put out in those situations, or the lineups that they can put out in those situations. Right. They're not pretty.
And also listen to that. What do you think first of all, how many minutes do you think Wiggins has played without Butler and Towns this season?
Well, considering it's Tibbs at the helm, I'm going to say like 50.
It's been 363. The Timberwolves have a net rating of -10.9 during that time. And they have a 9.9 when those three play together, but obviously they're not going to be playing together for some time. I just don't know. And Andy and I went through this on a previous podcast. There are a bunch of Timberwolves lineups that actually don't include Jimmy Butler that were just okay in the aggregate when you looked at their net rating, but their defensive ratings were like a minimum of 109. It was just they do not have the ability to field even close to an effective defense without him. And their most used lineup on the season without Butler is now that Bielitsa lineup, where you basically just replace Butler with Bielitsa, and that's been fine. That's a plus 9.8 per 100 possessions with a defensive rating of 105.5, which is, again, fine, but you move to, again, their second most used lineup without Butler, defensive rating 109.3. Third most used lineup without Butler, defensive rating 110.2. Fourth most used lineup without Butler, defensive rating 114.4. And it goes on and on from there.
Yeah, there's definitely some problems going on there. So you picked the Wolves and the Clippers to miss?
Yeah, I think that's where I'm at right now. It could maybe, like, in the next 20 minutes, it'll change back. But
last thing on the Wolves, did you guys see Tibbs screaming at Jay Crowder the other night?
I didn't see him screaming at Jay Crowder. I saw the play, man, that I'm assuming made him scream at Jay Crowder.
I'm in Dan's boat.
I just sent you guys the video. Whether you watch it now or after the podcast doesn't matter to me, but it's wild.
So I also just want to point out that that means that the three teams we're universally the most confident in, considering the Nuggets were on the fringe for Dan, are the Jazz, the Pelicans, and the Blazers, which is pretty much what we all expected, right?
That is crazy.
If the Blazers end up getting the third seed, do we need to give, like, Terry Stotts some Coach of the Year love or something? I know the roster has
probably
been, yeah, just because they have the continuity in their favor, but that's when you look at their roster, that's not necessarily a good thing.
No, there's no way I would have looked at that roster preseason and thought third seed.
I'm still gonna say no, just because Coach of the Year is a zero sum award, and Dwayne Casey should win it.
I think Dwayne Casey's the pick,
but Casey should too. Yeah,
but I'm just, if the Blazers get the third seed, like, because this isn't a situation that you have in New Orleans where if the Pelicans get the third seed, it's just, oh, Anthony Davis is amazing.
I mean, if you want to have him on the ballot, that's fine by me. I don't think he would deserve a first place vote still.
Casey is
in the
my
conversation
pick.
I would at least put him there, but yeah, I'm with you guys. I think Dan and I even picked Dwayne Casey as Coach of the Year a couple episodes back. He's been really good.
I'm watching that Tibbs video right now, by the way, and I want to just die laughing.
He's just screaming, "You mother effer," to Jay Crowder in the middle of a game.
Rudy Gobert's face in the screenshot below it too, when he knows it's about it. I love that Jay Crowder's been in Utah for a minute and was one of the first people to run up to Jeff Teague when he's
already like the emotional leader of the team. It's crazy.
And not surprising at all.
That's just awesome. Amazing how, like, emotionally shattered he was by the Cavaliers.
Do you think this was a question that was asked? I think Zach Lowe asked it on the Low Post to David Griffin when he did a Sloan podcast with him. Does that impact the way you view LeBron James's legacy at all, that his teams are so – and it's not an opinion. His teams, at least over the past, I would say dating back to his final year in Miami, have become mentally fragile.
This year more than any other, we've heard a lot about that kind of stuff with LeBron. That it's just – I think it was – it was another Low Post, and I think this one was with Windhorst. They were saying that there's just tons of examples of it being really hard to play with him for, like, psychological reasons. But I think we could say the same thing about Michael Jordan, right?
In a different way, though, because I think Jordan was so hard to play with because of the competitive spirit and demanding the best out of everybody.
Yeah,
I mean, for me, like, the narrative that we've heard around LeBron this year kind of reinforces my view that LeBron is the best basketball player we've ever seen, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's the greatest or has had the best career.
Yeah, I saw you tweet that the other day, actually, and I think that's a good way to phrase it. Best versus greatest.
There's definitely a distinction.
Yeah, I think so too. And that, when as soon as I saw that written out the way you did, I thought, oh yeah, that makes a ton of sense to me.
Now, do you both of you have the Jazz getting in the playoffs then, right? If neither of you picked them in your bottom two?
I'm not as confident as I was like 2 weeks ago, but I still think they'll get in. Their remaining schedule is pretty easy, I think.
They had a 90% chance to get in, according to 538, and then the Western Conference that was won all Western Conference.
Peak of their winning streak. I think that was when they were 11 straight wins.
Yeah, it's a combination for me of them being better than the record would indicate, having an easy remaining schedule, having Gobert back, which they haven't had all season, Donovan Mitchell continuing to get better. Like, everything points towards an upward trajectory, and you can't say the same about all the other teams.
They have the sixth best net rating in the West this season. Like, for the season. That's encapsulating all their struggles, including the win streak. That lineup with having Crowder and Ricky Rubio in it, it's only played in four games because Rubio was injured, but I think it's Ingles, Mitchell, Rubio, Gobert, and Crowder. You're basically subbing out Favors for Crowder. That, it's been crazy. It destroys opponents statistically. I think there are plus a zillion points per 100 possessions or something like that. And the relative simplicity of their schedule is kind of a big deal for me too. But it seems that it's weird that the Spurs don't have their best player, have the hardest schedule remaining in the league, and picking them to be outside the playoffs is kind of hot takey, but the Jazz are sitting here in 10th and we're all just like, yeah, they'll probably get in.
Well, here's the crux of my case for them. Since Gobert came back on January 19th, he's averaging 15 points, 11 rebounds, 2.5 blocks, shooting 61% from the field, and Utah's plus 10.2 points per 100 possessions when he's on the floor, and they're allowing 98.2. when he's on the floor. It looks like they've got last season's Rudy Gobert back, just in time too for this playoff push. Obviously, that return, that 11 game win streak has been since this return too. They're a completely different team when they have a healthy Rudy Gobert available. Thibodeau said this during that ESPN broadcast the other night against the Jazz. I think he said it a couple times even, that Gobert is a defense unto himself, which is an interesting quote, especially coming from he's been revered as one of the best defensive minds in the league for the last several years. So as long as Gobert's on the floor, they're going to defend the crap out of people. And I think they get just enough offense from Donovan Mitchell. Joe Ingles has been ridiculous again this season. There's enough talent up and down the roster to support that one-man defense. And we've mentioned the remaining schedule a couple times. I think all those ingredients together makes them seem like a fairly comfortable shot. Now, like I said, I'm not as confident as I was in the during the win streak, but it still looks like a fairly safe bet.
But Andy, all Gobert does is take close range shots, so he's pretty replaceable, and anyone could fill that role.
And it's amazing how often you still see that stuff. Oh, he needs to add a jump hook. No, he doesn't.
He needs to shoot from the corners.
I've never gotten that argument. Like, if it's so easy to dunk the ball and to take close shots and be a roll man all the time, then why doesn't everyone do it?
Yes, exactly. If every player could dunk or attempt to dunk on like all of their shots, they would do it. Completely right.
A team we haven't really talked about too much, and we've all penciled them in for a playoff team, the Pelicans. What is their is the buttress of their case just, man, Anthony Davis is really good?
Yeah. I mean, Anthony Davis is basically like a basketball god now. So, yeah.
I was going to talk about them earlier when we were talking about which team are we most confident in, like which one could we come closest to making that bet on. I almost said the Pelicans just because...
You're drunk?
...of this, of this huge clump of teams that we've been talking about. Anthony Davis is certainly the best individual player, right?
There was the play that just quintessentially illustrates what he's been doing was, I don't know if you saw it, it was the Pelicans Spurs game where New Orleans came from behind to win. And again, I know the Spurs didn't have Aldridge down the stretch of that game, but Jrue Holiday misses two free throws and there's four guys around the Spurs around Anthony Davis, and he still gets the offensive rebound.
Yep. And Jrue Holiday's been really good in this stretch too, so I think they have two
missed free throws in crunch time, notwithstanding.
Yeah, Just to we've thrown these numbers out on the podcast before, but I think they bear repeating. Since DeMarcus Cousins went down, Anthony Davis is averaging 33.3 points, 13.3 rebounds, 2.4 blocks, 2.3 steals, 2.2 assists, 1.2 threes, shooting 50% from the field and 35% from three. I think he can, like, what's maybe even crazier is I think he can conceivably maintain that for the rest of the season. And to me, that's enough to keep them in the playoffs.
So since Cousins has gotten hurt and without Drew Holiday, Davis is averaging 48.2 points, 19.4 rebounds, and 6.2 blocks per 36 minutes.
Holy cow.
And I totally just made that up, but you believed it.
Oh, yeah.
He's been that good.
That's funny. Yeah, I totally believe that.
The only thing that I think I worry about is Anthony Davis hasn't been historically the healthiest basketball player. And his usage over the last seven games alone is over 34. It's just if he gets injured, the Pelicans are done, or maybe defenses find a way to adjust. But at the same time, he's been hitting a bunch of tough shots. The Pelicans haven't exactly been feasting on cupcake opponents during this stretch. Like the game against Miami that went into overtime, the Heat are sometimes a good team. Milwaukee, we think, is a good team. That was a great overtime victory. The victory against the Spurs, even though they lost Aldridge, was big time. I still see holes for them, but they're getting good performances from Emeka Okafor in addition to Drew Holiday.
And that's an awesome story.
Anthony Davis is just a superhuman. Like I don't even know. And his usage, it's incredible. He has not been turning the ball over during this stretch too, which has been something that's not really talked about with him. But when you look at some of the shots he's had to take and his usage, he has a turnover rate below 7 over his last 7 games, which is just, that's incredible to me. I can't picture them falling out of the playoff race, but also they were not like that good of a team with DeMarcus Cousins. They started to play better before he went down, but I'm wondering if that's a red flag in any way, because they weren't this dominant team with DeMarcus Cousins, and all of a sudden now they're 9 games over 500 and they're tied in the loss column with the third seed in the West. They're one game back in the win column. Is that a red flag to anybody or no?
I wonder more if it's a red flag for Cousins.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing pretty much.
I've been a Boogie defender pretty much throughout his career just because of the amount of talent that he has and the individual production. But the evidence is mounting that it's really hard to win with him. And what Davis is doing isn't sustainable over the course of a full season, I think, just because he's ridiculous. But it seems to be yet another knock against Cousins, which isn't really what he wants entering an offseason where he could opt out and hit free agency.
To be fair, though, before he went down, it did seem like,
they were figuring it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's more of a red flag for Cousins than for the Pelicans playoff hopes.
I think I was going to say pretty much the same thing. I think there are a lot of people who would argue this is just more evidence that you can't build a winner around DeMarcus Cousins. I'm not sure if I'm on that boat,
yeah,
but
yeah,
I think
they were going through a 7-1 streak before he went down. So like the hot streak kind of started with him. I'm probably more on the latter part of Adam's case that it's probably might be a knock against Boogie, but I'm still not. I believe that you could build a winner around him. If the Pelicans had more shooters for most of the season around Anthony Davis and DeMarcus Cousins, or just wings in general, they probably would have been better off from the jump.
Yeah, just in case I'm not clear enough, like I think it allows for that possibility. I don't subscribe to that theory. And I think that a lot of the struggles that we saw, like Dan just said, comes from pretty terrible roster construction.
Well, speaking of which, I'm very interested to see how much he gets.
Let me get one more thing in. Oh, never mind. Go ahead.
I'm so fascinated because of what Adam said. That has to impact his free agency value. His injury impacts his free agency. Who? That's my question.
I just feel like there's got to be a couple. I know that the money is like super tight this summer, but there's got to be a couple max guys still.
I don't think he's going to get a max.
I don't think so either. I mean, I was writing an article. I think it was a week or two ago, about a free agent target for every team, and I ended up leaving DeMarcus Cousins and DeAndre Jordan just out of that article completely, because I wasn't picking incumbent free agents for teams, so I didn't list them for the Clippers and Pelicans. But I was looking at it, and one, the big man market's oversaturated. Two, Cousins is working off this usually career-altering, if not ruining, injury. And as Andy said, three, the money's just not available. I don't know where the max offer sheet's coming from. It would make most sense. It would have to be from a team that would first have to, go through the salary-shedding motions. If the Bucks decided to renounce, Jabari and then, trade off some of their crappy salary.
And four, he's going to be 28 this offseason, which means that you're paying him through becoming 32 years old.
Which is, in a vacuum, fine, but that has more than, I would think, not more to do with Achilles, his injury. Though. Well, yeah, but he could be 25 and coming off an Achilles injury, and I think that would still be the issue.
The Mavericks have a history of paying a ton of money to recent Achilles tears, right?
Yeah, but the Mavericks also have a recent history of missing out on big free agents.
That's true, too.
Boogie will commit to them only to end up back in Sacramento.
That's
his prediction.
Yeah. who else has cap space? Or I don't even know if the Mavericks do. I just
the Lakers.
Well, and that will also, but to Adam's point, though, that's really where the age thing comes in, right? Because most of the teams that have appreciable cap space, Boogie's now at that age. They're rebuilding teams, and Boogie's now at that age where, particularly post-Achilles, you're not going to want him to headline your rebuild. Maybe the Lakers could talk themselves into it, like Adam said, if they miss on everybody else. But Max?
Before he got hurt, my favorite Lakers scenario was LeBron and Boogie both going there. But obviously that's a much different proposition now.
Did you see the tweet? I love Lakers fans. It was after the Kawhi Leonard stuff happened, with Pop saying he wouldn't play again this season, and someone tweeted at Bleacher Report / Basketball Insiders Eric Pincus asking, is there any way for the Lakers to sign Paul George and LeBron James and then trade for Kawhi Leonard? And I just couldn't stop laughing because it wasn't done in jest. It was just an actual question.
I mean, I'm about to propose a ridiculously ludicrous scenario, too. So what if Cousins just decides that he's tired of hearing about how he can't win, signs a one-year minimum deal with the Warriors just to prove that he can be on a title team, and then hits free agency again?
That would be something.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, then he's going to end up...
Spurs would also be an interesting spot for that narrative.
He would probably be a perennial all-star on the Spurs still if he went there. That would probably be the one fit, but I wouldn't want the Spurs shelling it. Even if you could get rid of Pau Gasol, I still wouldn't want him there. And, Adam, if he did sign a one-year minimum with the Warriors, think about how all the minutes he would lose to Jordan Bell. That might torpedo his stock.
I'm just trying to imagine people's reactions to that happening.
That tweet that you mentioned, Dan, made me think of this tweet from Kirk Seriousface, former guest of the pod. He came on and previewed the Mavericks for us one year. He said, I'm seeing, man, Randall is so good stuff from fans who wanted to trade him. I need the Lakers to be good again soon. Knicks entitlement makes no sense. Boston entitlement is stale now. Warriors entitlement is whiny. No, give me unfiltered, loud and proud Laker exceptionalism.
I mean, it's true.
Yeah.
They are very proud.
Sure, go ahead.
They've got to be the leakiest team in the league from their own, trying to manipulate the narrative, right? Because you hear, people think the Mavericks are going to give Julius Randle $17 to $18 million a year. No. Julius Randle's not getting $17 million a year.
They are, yeah, they're a fun fan base for sure. Should we move on to the tankers? I feel like we've kind of exhausted the Western playoff race.
Does anyone have predictions that they're willing to throw out for what the Western playoff bracket's going to look like now? We have the two teams that are going to be out, but do you have your top eight?
No, not even close.
Yeah, I don't think I could do that either.
I'm comfortable predicting a Warriors-Rockets conference finals.
Yeah. Oh, okay, I'm not. What if...
Oh, interesting.
What if... Just go with me. What if the Spurs get in? Kawhi's back. Kawhi's close to Kawhi. That's a team, if they end up facing the Rockets in the first or the second round, that's a team I think that could still give Houston problems. The Rockets are the superior team, but if you have Kawhi Leonard on the floor with the Spurs, you wouldn't give them a shot in that series?
To win a couple games, maybe.
Yeah, I would give them. I mean, I
winning a couple games in the series is like putting you on the verge of winning the series.
No, I mean literally a couple.
I don't think I would be. There's too much to work out there. I think he's got his quad injury, and there's just all this drama. It's very un-Spurs what's going on right now. But Houston is like they're just a machine right now.
Right, and they've lost one game, blah, 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 with Capella and Paul and Harden in the lineup. They're spectacular, but
there's enough firepower for them to keep up. And they're so deep this season, too, the Rockets. They can play like four different styles. I think they're a much different team than they were last season.
I would have no desire if I were them to face the Spurs in the first or the second round. That would not be – especially if you win the number one seed and if your reward ends up being facing San Antonio.
That would be interesting. Yeah, 1-8. The 1-8 that's probably the most interesting 1-8 matchup for sure.
I also would like to see Warriors Nuggets for some reason. I feel like the Nuggets can –
I think the Nuggets are the one team that could beat them.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that. In terms of 8 seeds, maybe.
Yeah, not including the Rockets.
Okay. The one team in the West that can beat the Warriors aside from the Rockets is the Nuggets. That's it. That's what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Just because
they've been like relatively the team with the offensive
firepower. Yeah.
Yeah.
It almost doesn't matter that their defense can be so bad because the Warriors already maximize their possessions. So the ability to actually score with them matters.
I agree with the argument. I don't agree with the conclusion from that argument. I don't think. I would probably take over the Nuggets. After beyond the Rockets, I'd probably still go. Well, the Spurs aren't healthy, so I can't use that hypothetical. I might still go the Thunder. I still have hope for them. I'm holding that hope.
That ship is sinking fast for me.
It is ridiculous that Adam can say that, not sound crazy, and yet the team he's talking about might not,
might not make the playoffs.
Yeah. Man, the Western Conference.
Yeah, I mean, like the team that I think you don't want to play in the first round is currently sitting in 10th in the standings. So who knows what's going to happen?
If the Spurs and the Thunder miss the playoffs, what happens? Honestly, does Paul George leaves, right? He leaves.
Okay. Yeah.
He has to go east at that point, though. Are you going to go to the Lakers and just not make the playoffs at all again next year? Like, what?
That's a good point, actually. I don't know why anybody would willingly come over at this point. Pull the Gordon Hayward. Go to the easier conference.
Yeah, but then when LeBron is on the Sixers, do you really want to mess with that?
That's true, too. It's a lose-lose proposition.
Dario Saric actually just killed that idea by dunking on the Cavaliers at the end of that loss.
The reaction to that was so funny.
Joel Embiid was so mad at Saric until Jordan Clarkson like started talking, and he like focused on him. But so the Tankers, really quick.
Yeah, okay. That's what I was looking at.
This is more league-wide. Who, I believe I threw this in at the end of a podcast a week or two ago to Andy about who his bottom three teams are going to be. Adam, do you have picks for which teams you think are going to finish with the bottom three record?
All of them.
I'll name it. So to review right now, the Grizzlies have the worst record in the NBA, which I'm sure Marc Gasol is thrilled about.
And they've lost 13 straight. So yep. They are cruising right now.
They haven't won since the Spurs were a playoff team.
I mean, I think this is even harder than picking the Western playoff teams.
Because you're picking against teams that don't want to win games. It's like, yeah.
Well, it's kind of like that. But like, I think I told you this on the side the other day. Like, tanking is such an interesting thing because it happens before games, not necessarily during it. Like, all these players... You can't tell me that they're trying to lose the game once tip-off happens.
Right, but it's...
So it's a balance of which front office is trying to do the most to tank and has the players who can't necessarily pull it off when they're on the court.
Just look at the Grizzlies roster if you want to look at the players who can't pull it off.
But like, Tyreke Evans is better than anybody on the Hawks.
But will they even play him for the rest of the season?
But that's why I have no idea. That's why he's saying it happens before the games. My counter argument would be if you look at, and they're not doing it anymore because Mark Cuban was fined $600,000. But you looked at like some of the Mavericks' closing lineups, and you see Dirk and Harrison Barnes both on the bench in those games. Tanking happens during games. I'm convinced of it.
From the coaching staff, sure.
That's still during the game, and that's a huge part of it.
Okay, that's fair. But I think that's also an exception because Rick Carlisle is so entrenched as their head coach that he can afford to do something like that. You're never going to see that happen with an interim head coach or somebody who doesn't enjoy like unabashed job security. Like Fred Hoiberg isn't going to do that.
Harrison Barnes on the bench down the stretch is probably the right move either way. The Grizzlies have 18 wins. That's the worst. They have the worst record in the league. The Bulls have the 8th worst record in the league, and they have 21 wins. So it's about the tank race is about as tight as 3 through 10 is in the West. You could pick any three of these teams finishing bottom three, and I would not be surprised.
I mean, I'm gonna put on my Homer hat.
Go ahead.
I'm going to put on my Homer hat with the Hawks just because only the Suns among these tanking teams have a more difficult schedule, and I think that the Hawks have the least talented roster of all of them. Assuming that Tyreek is allowed to play again.
The John Collins, Torian Prince shade over here, Adam. Jeez.
There will never be any shade towards the best player in Wake Forest history, but there will be some towards Prince.
Whoa, you don't like Torian Prince? I love Torian Prince.
I think that he settles in as a role player throughout his career.
Had this debate too.
That's like 75% of the league. You don't like Torian Prince either, Bales?
I don't. We've talked about this. I do not consider him a building block.
What is your?
what is your problem?
Here's my point. No. So here's Torian my point though. Prince. Is he supposed to be a star? He was drafted at number 12, I think, in 2016.
I mean, he's good.
Basically saying the Boston version of Jay Crowder, who can run pick and roll, is not going to be a good player.
No way.
Get the hell out of here. Yeah, the two of you.
His value has stagnated or declined, even though he's making more three-pointers. The development isn't there. The consistency isn't there. He doesn't do that many things well. I just don't see it.
If you keep him around during
the Hawks rebuild, like he's a sixth man at best.
He's become a better passer, even though he turns the ball over probably too much. And he's being asked to play a role on offense that he probably shouldn't play anyway. You're going to say that his value has declined, even though he's making more of his threes. I think that's ludicrous to say. The one concern I will have, and I'm going to reiterate that granted he's an older sophomore because he's going to turn 24 this month, but you can't really, at 6'8", he kind of has a little bit of Rodney Hood syndrome where you don't want to match him up with bigger wings, but that might come in time if he becomes stronger or if he just gets more experience. I'm not saying he's going to be a star, but to be like down on Torian Prince is just very weird to me.
Well, I think if you're at a point where the Hawks are in a rebuild that's really just starting, you need your young guys to have star potential. And I don't view anyone on this roster as a sure thing long-term keeper other than John Collins.
John Collins is not going to be a star, though. Like, is that a hot take?
That's a little hot takey.
I don't know if you can, like, unequivocally say that.
What is John Collins going to be then? What is his ceiling? I'm not trying to say his ceiling isn't higher than Torian Prince's, but if you're going to say that he's the one player on the team with a superstar,
I think he could be
ceiling,
a 20 and 10
guy. Well, I
didn't
say superstar. Yeah, I mean, I think that you can look at him as a potential all-star reserve in the Eastern Conference, and that's a lot more than you can say about anybody else.
Maybe. I just find it weird that what are we all of a sudden measuring like late lottery picks against Donovan Mitchell, so we have to be down on Torian Prince? I find that very weird.
I mean, I've been down on him for a while.
All right, my bottom three is going to be the Grizzlies, the Suns, and the Hawks.
In that order?
Yes. I think the Grizzlies finish with the worst record.
You're picking the standings? Because that's what they are now, right?
Grizzlies. I've got, Tankathon has the Hawks as the 5th worst record, but they do have the same record as the Kings and the Mavericks. So, yeah, pretty much what it is right now.
But it'll be great when, like, tiebreakers, you're actually penalized for winning. If it comes to that,
yeah,
that'd be fantastic.
So the tiebreaker, it says on Tankathon, the tiebreaker is the random drawing.
Oh, they don't go. They should. All right. Well, they should change that. They should penalize teams that have like the better conference.
That would be pretty funny.
That would be hysterical.
I'm gonna go with Hawks, Kings, Mavericks.
The Kings, really? I feel like they're so peppy, even though they're like numbers are historically bad. Maybe I'm just I've been watching too many like Bogdan clips.
He's good.
Or I'm just really biased against the Kings at this point.
Which is probably fair.
For no particular reason.
Oh, there's a particular reason.
Oh, there's a particular reason.
I'm going to file a formal complaint with you about your particular reason after this podcast.
How would you grade their season so far?
I'm losing my train of thought here. Yes, Bogdanović is good. A lot better. And he pointed this out to me, too, in another podcast. I don't want to make it seem like we're just re-recording, but he watched more of him coming into the NBA. I had no idea that he was going to be such a good, like, passer, pick-and-roll ball handler. Yeah, I'll put good in bunny quotes because the Kings could be a mess. But he's been super good. I still really like Willie Cauley-Stein. I'm a little bit disappointed with how Scal has followed up the end of last year, even as he's gotten more playing time this year. I kind of love a little bit that Jakar Sampson is getting minutes in the NBA again. That's always great stuff.
How old is he?
I think he's like 40. No, he is 24. He's about to turn 25.
The Kings play blow my mind, but go ahead.
I don't mind watching the Kings anymore. Is that a terrible thing to say?
I think that's legit.
I hate that Zach Randolph is on this team. I'm not even talking about, like, I'm not looking at his minutes, and I think Dave Yeager, I don't know that he saved his job, but we killed him on the podcast earlier in the year for the minutes distribution with the centers. He's kind of helped himself looking at the optics just because he doesn't play veterans every night and he's given some more minutes to the youth. But you look at like some of the lineups the Kings have been running out, is just bizarre. That loss to the Jazz on Saturday, they started Fox, Bogdanović, Jackson, Kufos, and Randolph. What is that?
The random Kufos start.
Is what that is?
Is that like a tanking move, or is that what is that?
I think it is. What is that?
Well, he's been weird with the center stuff all season. There's been like a random Kufos start every 2 weeks. I don't know.
I blame the front office more than him for that. By the way, they gave him a roster with basically a gazillion bigs. I never understood that.
True.
My bottom three, I think I'm going with Grizzlies, Hawks, and I'm going to say Mavericks. I really want to put the Magic there, but I feel like they're going to sleepwalk their way into some random Eastern Conference wins.
Yeah, for me, it comes down to the teams that you don't want to bet against to a certain extent. Like, the Bulls are, hilarious as this sounds, obviously the best team of this bunch, I think. I don't want to bet against Devin Booker. I have trouble with the Grizzlies just because Marc Gasol has declined so much this year, but we know what he can do, and we know how motivated he is to prove that this isn't a G League team. So there are just so many weird factors here.
The Grizzlies have to shut him down, right? Because I understand I'm not sure who said this, so I guess that this is terrible to say, but someone was talking about how the Suns have basically admitted that shutting down Eric Bledsoe kind of soured the relationship there, but like Marc Gasol is visibly pissed off while he's playing. You have to shut it. That's not even a tanking move. It's just, if he's not going to have the patience to understand what we're doing here, and that's why, and not to get too profound on this, that's why you never should have gotten to a situation where you needed to pick Marc Gasol over your head coach.
They should have traded him too.
Yeah.
He should have been
gone. And then now, what impression is? I think Tyreke Evans's ribs injury is real, but like, what if it's a thing where he can come back and they don't bring him back?
Then they won't bring him back.
Okay, so you didn't trade him, and now you're leaving this lasting tanking impression on him. That's
another
such a joke. Mess.
It was amazing that they didn't trade him for, you know, whatever they were offered, and then talks of buyout happened like after the deadline. And too.
Oh wait, there was actually I didn't even see that.
Yeah, I missed that.
I'm pretty sure I saw. Maybe I'm thinking of somebody else, so hopefully I didn't misspeak there.
No, did you confuse Tyreke Evans with Corey Brewer again? I hate when that happens.
I mean, I don't think it matters too much the impression you leave with the Memphis fans when it's going to be Seattle soon anyway, right?
God, Adam.
We got to get expansion, Adam.
We need to screen our podcast best a little better before we bring him on. He's out here taking the Grizzlies away from the city of Memphis. He hasn't been on in 6 months.
I think that's probably a good spot to wrap it up. Do you guys have anything else on the great Tankathon or the Western Conference race?
Do you think bad impressions at the end?
Yeah, that was the only team that we really didn't mention would have been the Brooklyn Nets, who have been, they're 1-9 over their last 10. I don't know what, they try really hard and they don't have their pick. So I think that precludes them from the worst record conversation. Yeah. But are they an organic, like, are they at a risk of being an organic tanker just because they've been bad with, especially defensively, with Dinwiddie and Russell on the floor. And that's kind of the combination you have to milk over these final games because both of them can get extensions this summer, I believe, and then you have both of them entering free agency in 2019, and now they're in this weird spot where you have to start thinking about they're a fascinating situation. I don't think enough people care about the Nets or watch the Nets, even though I still find them fun to watch when they're losing, to really dig into it. But they're in a fascinating situation because they've done everything right under Sean Marks, in my opinion, relative to their situation. Because you can't – like, they didn't have – they didn't control the rights to their own picks. They're finally going to get all those back starting next year. And yet now you're getting to a point where you're almost going to be penalized for finding these diamonds among the dregs because Joe Harris is a free agent this summer. Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, restricted free agent next year. Russell, restricted free agent next year. Dinwiddie, slated for UFA, I believe, next year. So now you have to reinvest in this roster if you want to keep any of the young guys that you've taken flyers on. So they're going to be fascinating to me. And the defense has been, which has been, relative to expectations, again, has been kind of a high point for them. It's been really, really bad with Dinwiddie and Russell on the floor this year.
I trust the talent there, at least relative to the rest of the tankers. They're minus 2.1 for the season per 100 possessions when Dinwiddie and Russell are on, which obviously isn't good.
111.6 defensive rating, though.
Yeah, it's better than their overall net rating of minus 4.7, and it's probably going to be better if they maintain that. It's probably going to be better than some of the stuff that the Grizzlies or the Kings or the Hawks or the other teams we've talked about
also
would
fair.
Throw out there. So I think I'm mostly like I'm pretty high on the Dinwiddie Russell combination still. Like I think that can work, not to the extent that they'll like go on a run or anything, but I think they'll win just enough games to avoid.
Do you think they're the second best team in this? By virtue of, I guess, trying to win in this Tankathon behind the Bulls? Or are they the best team, maybe?
Yeah, I don't even know if I'd be... I'm not 100% confident in saying the Bulls are the best team in this group.
Well, could they be the first tanker in history that have to shut down their youngsters that need to be playing more because they're winning too much?
I think the Bulls, Magic, and Nets would be like in that conversation for me. I think you could make an argument for any of those three teams being the best.
I would want to include the Suns there also.
Oh, yeah, because they've got Devin Booker, and Elfrid Payton's been feisty since he got there, so that's probably true.
Josh Jackson, too? Oh, my God.
Yep. Yeah, I just have trouble including the Nets in this conversation just because they don't have anything to lose for.
No, it's just they're...
Like, the other teams are going to keep getting worse, and they're not.
Okay, so here's my thing with the Nets is that they feel like less Lakery, though, where the Lakers are going to actively try and win games out of spite, it seems like, and they're going to play Isaiah Thomas a bunch of minutes. The Nets are going to take risks and experiment with lineup combinations, and they're not that they're not going to care about the result, but I don't think they're trying to – this regime is so – not so far removed from the draft day disasters or the draft pick disasters, but they've moved so far beyond it that their tanking could be more, like, incidental than intentional. So, like, that type of thing. But that's just me. For them, that's why they would only belong in the conversation. I mean, we've seen it; they've lost a bunch of games in recent weeks. So,
I'm going to say they stay out of the bottom three.
I think they ultimately will too. The last thing I wanted to ask, because I know Andy's trying to get out here, do you guys have a favorite tanker to watch?
None of them.
All right, I guess that's a good spot to end. Peace out, everyone.
Mine. I would go either Brooklyn, who we just talked about, or Orlando for no other reason than Mario Hezonja, which I actually was like tempted to bring up earlier, I think it's so funny. I mean, sorry to Magic fans, but they declined this 22-year-old's option for his last season on his rookie contract, and now he's like legitimately good for a couple months now.
Wonder if that was intentional? Like, he was just waiting and biding his time.
Somebody tweeted that at me the other day. They were like, this is the stealth tank move from an individual player. he hated being on the Magic so much that he tanked his own career for a couple years, and now he's going to have a chance to sign somewhere else.
Yeah, I didn't make culpa with
that. He's going to be an interesting free agent.
Yeah, I had said that he could only make what his team option was from every team, but I need to make culpa on that. The Magic can only pay him the option that they declined. I don't know. I'm not saying that he would get. I think it's $5.2 million or whatever it was. But even if it's a difference of like $200K, where another team's only offering him $5 or something, that's not enough of a trump card for him to go back to Orlando.
No, I don't think so either. And I don't think he's going to get offered much more than that either from any other team. But I'm with you. I would be stunned if he went back to the Magic.
I'd be shocked. And it's great that he could possibly ruin their tank on his way out. That would be even better.
He's been awesome.
To answer your question, though, Dan, the Suns would be my choice just because the Josh Jackson growth and watching Devin Booker, who is so much better this year than he was last year. Those two pieces alone, plus Elfrid Payton trying in Phoenix, those push them ahead of everybody else for me.
That was the same answer for the exact reason. And I think part of what I like watching is I can't figure out Josh Jackson's offensive game, really. I think we're starting to see that he's a better passer than most people realize coming out of the draft. But his, he can't shoot three. He's not a reliable three-point shooter yet. He'll have, those nights where he goes maybe 3 of 4, or he's, 2 of 5 or something. But then he's 0 of 3, he's 1 of 5, and then his free throws are even more, confusing. There's the game against, I think it was Memphis, he was 10 of 13, and he was 8 of 11 in a game against the Pelicans. I think those games were back-to-back. And then he faces that game of OKC, and he's 2 of 5. He's so fascinating to me. And I think the defensive ceiling is there. He can't guard fours yet, but I think he'll get there. But that's why the Suns are my favorite. Devin Booker's fun to watch, even though the metrics still don't love him. But you try getting the metrics to love you on that Phoenix Suns team.
They're coming around on him, though.
Yep.
The defensive metrics are not, though, if I'm not mistaken, right?
His offense is that much better now.
Yeah, and Elfrid Payton has been good since he was there. And then TJ Warren sometimes does some things. So the Suns are probably my favorite tanker, with the Nets are a close second. And they're not really a tanker, which is probably why I didn't consider them.
Somebody tweeted at me the other day and asked if just basically pick between Klay Thompson and Devin Booker. And my instant reaction was Klay Thompson, obviously. But it's interesting to look at those two, their numbers side by side. I was surprised. That's all I will say. So Booker has definitely been better this season. I'm with you guys on that. Hopefully he'll go for 70 again in another meaningless game. Anything else, guys?
No, I think we successfully didn't help make sense of the Western Conference playoff race at all. But that is
goal.
Yeah. Every bit as crazy as we anticipated before we started recording. If you want to shout at us or digitally shout at us for any of our takes, especially our hotter takes, you can find all of us on Twitter. Adam, Dan said, is on Twitter at Frommal09, FROMAL09. Dan is at Dan Favale, FAVALE. I'm at Andrew D. Bailey. The show is at Hardwood Knox. The sponsor is at NBA_math. Make sure you're following all of those accounts. They will enrich your life. Speaking of enriching your life, leaving a review or a rating will do so. Telling your friends to subscribe will also enrich your life, because then you can talk about these wonderful conversations that you've heard on Hardwood Knox, and you'll just love talking about the NBA. Coerce your friends into subscribing. Steal their phones, like Dan said. We appreciate all that. Until next time, we leave you with the shout-out to Bino Udrih. And because I'm feeling nice today, I'm going to leave you with a shout-out to Kyle Anderson, too.